morning. This music I'm playing is meant to represent the inexorability of fate. It just continues to do what it does, no matter what we do to interfere with it. My final topic for the week, and I have to say, it has been an absolutely revelatory and delightful week that I have shared here with you. I would especially like to thank all the wonderful people who have engaged in extended and deep, wide-ranging conversation with me and one another during this week. It's been really fun for me, and thank you. So the last remaining question that seems to be linked to all the other topics of the week is, are we determined, or do we indeed have, in this wide universe, what has been called free will? Or are our stories simply determined and we are moving through them? We cannot see their ends, but nevertheless, their ends already exist somewhere. And so I thought I would begin with an old story from China. It's a very short story, and then we'll explore a bit of the story of Oedipus the King. But for the start of this, this is called The Runaway Horse. Once, at the edge of a small village, there lived an old man and his son. Of all the people in the village, these two were the most poor, and the only possession the young man could call his own was his horse. She was a fine young mare, and every morning he would leap up upon her back, hear her thunder across the fields, feel the wind in his face, and it was the only freedom he ever really knew. But never, ever would he ride his mare into the forest across the fields, for the forest was not deep, and beyond those trees stretched the plains, and riding on them were the nomads. Fierce warrior people who had attacked the village in times past, but no one could really remember it. It was more like a story on the old men's lips. Well, one day, the young man was seated in front of his hut, and there, placidly tethered to a post by a leather thong, stood his mare, when suddenly she reared up, her nostrils flared, and she snapped the thong and began to gallop away. He waved to her, "Come back! Come back, please! Come back!" But she seemed not to hear him. She galloped across the fields into the forest and was gone. And was when the villagers saw that his one possession in the world had run off, they all came crowding into the hut and they said, "Oh, what great misfortune! Look, you lost your horse. Now you are twice as poor." Twice as poor. And they all pushed one another out the door. But his old father narrowed his eyes and looked at his son and asked, "How do you know this is not a blessing? How do you know?" Well, the young man thought to himself, "Losing my only horse, a blessing? How can that be?" And yet it wasn't but a few days later, he was lying in his bed when he heard the sound of horses' hoofs. He pushed himself up on his elbow and looked out his window, and there, charging back across the fields, came his mare, and next to her, a tall stallion, a war horse. Why, she had gone through the herds of the nomads, having followed their scent, and had cut loose a mate. And when the neighbor saw that there were now two horses tethered to the post instead of none at all, they came crowding into his hut and said, "Well, what great good fortune, look! Two horses, twice as many as one. This keeps up, you'll be a horse dealer." Yes, and they all pushed one another out the door. But his old father narrowed his eyes and looked at his son and asked, "How do you know this is not disaster? How do you know?" The young man thought to himself, losing a horse, then gaining two, a mating pair, disaster? How can that be? And yet it wasn't but a week later, he had chosen to climb up on to the back of the war horse. And the huge beast suddenly exploded, and all the young man could do was hold on. Why, the war horse did not know what to do with such a light load, that did not know how to ride. And so the giant horse began to make his way across the field. All the young man could do was hold on and wrap his fingers into the animal's mane. Suddenly they were in the forest itself, and the limbs were flying past the young man's head, and then the horse reared up and threw him to the ground. And in the fall to the earth, he broke his hip. And in great pain, he lay for many hours in the forest until the neighbors, afraid of even being there, found him and carried him home. And as they put him in his bed, they said, "Oh, what great misfortune. Look, you broke your hip. You'll never be the same." And they all left. But his old father, seeing the pain not only in his son's body, but in his eyes, asked, "How do you know? This is not a blessing. How do you know?" Well, the young man's hip indeed was broken, and it would not knit well. He was bedridden, and weak. Became months, and he could hear the children playing outside his window, and he wondered would he ever walk again. Until one morning, the gongs began to ring in all the corners of the village. This was a sign of danger. The young man heard commotion out his window. He pushed himself up on his window and looked out. There were people of the village running past with pitchforks and scythes, staves, anything they could find. It seemed that the nomads had exploded from the forest in an army and were galloping toward the farmers of the village. And in the battle, 9 out of 10 villagers who fought to defend their lives ended up losing them. But the young man, who could not rise to fight through no fault of his own, survived to live a long life, albeit with a limp. And so the old ones in China maintained that just beneath blessing crouches disaster, but always perched just above disaster, one finds blessing. And it is impossible to know which is really which. Thank you. An old Chinese story, The Runaway Horse. And in it, it's a curious mixture. What is good fortune and what is bad fortune, the story asks. Fortune, of course, is an idea that derives from determinism. We are determined. O fortuna, velut luna. The opening strains to the wonderful Carl Orff piece, Carmina Burana, translates as the following set of lines. O fortune, just as the moon stands constantly changing, always increasing or decreasing, detestable life, now difficult and then easy, deceptive, sharp mind, poverty, power, it melts them like ice. This old piece of early literature refers to fate. So before we explore more deeply the notion of a modern way of looking at whether we have free will or not, let's examine what the ancients felt about it. In Greek mythology, the Greeks were by far the very best at creating stories that twist and turn, as I'm sure you well know. There were the three fates. Clotho was the first. She would spin the thread of life. Her sister then would measure it out, and the final sister, Atropos, would take those terrifying scissors and snip it off at the end of one's life. And there is no better story to describe how the ancient Greeks felt about the unavoidability of one's destiny. Luke, it is your destiny. Yes, the unavoidable nature of it than Oedipus the king. It's an interesting tale. I'm not going to perform it, but just to refresh your memories. In the great city of Thebes, these were during the years of the mighty Theseus on his way to conquer the Minotaur and Crete, and his cousin Hercules and his 12 labors, these 500 BC or so. In the city of Thebes, the beautiful Queen Jocasta and her husband Linnaeus could not have a child. Years passed, and so finally they went to the Oracle at Delphi to ask, why are we childless? And the Oracle gave them an answer they did not want. You will no longer be childless, but your son will kill his father and marry his mother. You can imagine how pleased the couple was to hear this. Home they went to Thebes, and sure enough, Jocasta conceived a child, and he was born. And as soon as he was born, the couple, nodding to one another, decided it was best to just do away with this child. And so in the manner in which that was done, they decided to expose it to the elements. Did not give it a name, and so they gave it to a shepherd and told him, go out, expose this child to the elements, let it die. But in the tradition of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs and a host of other good stories, the shepherd did not have the heart to do this. However, prior to being given the child, the king took a bolt and bolted the child's ankles together. And they swelled terribly. And so the child, taken away from Thebes to the city of Corinth in secret by the shepherd, was named Oedipus, which means swollen feet. In fact, if you ever have pulmonary edema on the slopes of Mount Everest, the swelling in your lungs was named after this. And so, much the way Moses was found in the reeds and raised in the royal situation by the Queen of Egypt, so Oedipus, with his limp, but strong body and keen mind and good looks, was raised to young manhood in the city of Corinth. Merope, the queen, was his mother, and she loved him dearly, and Polybus, his father, never told the boy was a foundling child. Oedipus, of course, had no notion that this terrible curse lay upon him, and he grew up. However, one day, a drunken servant talked to the young prince and said, you're not the real son of the king and queen. You're not the real son. And Oedipus, this was the first that he had heard of it, was shocked. And so he decided he himself would go to the Oracle at Delphi to ask what exactly was going on. This proved to be a terrible mistake for him. He went and was told, yes, indeed, you will kill your father and marry your mother. He was horrified. And so he made his way back home. But as he did, he came to a place where three roads met, and there a narrow passage presented itself, and a man in a chariot blocked his way. The man was his own father on his way. And the two men, both proud, began to argue until finally a fight broke out, and Oedipus slew. So the first part of the tragedy came to pass. It was later, however, on a journey, that Oedipus was nearing Thebes, that city, and who should appear but the Sphinx herself. She guarded one of the roads that led into Thebes, terrorized the town, and she posed her riddle. She was with the body of a lion and the face of a woman. She was a creature very much feared by anyone who should happen along the road. The Sphinx had her riddle, very famous. What walks on four legs in the morning, walks on two legs at noon, and walks on three legs at night. No one had guessed this. The Sphinx had killed many. The city was in utter terror. Oedipus, however, being clever, thought a moment and said, "Oh, I know the answer to this. It is man. As a baby, you crawl on all fours in the morning of your life. In the noon of your life, you walk on two legs. And in the evening of your life, you use a cane. Therefore, you have three." At this, the Sphinx, completely off put by the fact that he had figured out her riddle, slew herself. Such things happen in these stories. Who should enter the city of Thebes, declared as the hero who had freed them from the terrible curse of the Sphinx, but Oedipus walked in, and here was Queen Jocasta, the widow of the slain king. No one in Thebes knew who had killed the king. And so it was that the people declared that Oedipus should be their new king on account of his exploits, and here conveniently was a beautiful queen who needed a new husband. Thusly, he married his mother, and they had four children, one of whom was Antigone. Time passed in Thebes. All seemed fine until a kind of curse of infertility swept the city. The women could no longer bear children. The crops withered in the fields. The people began to starve. No one knew what curse lay upon Thebes until finally it was said that someone should go to the oracle and ask why this was taking place. Someone went to the oracle at Delphi. Of course, the oracle was the mouthpiece, once under the presence of hallucinogenic fumes or other sorts of wonders, mysteries they were called, of either Zeus or the three fates. Some people even think that Zeus, king of the gods, feared the three sisters. There are a great many versions. He would have been wise to do so. In any event, the fates told the messenger that there was someone in the city who had killed the king and needed to be either killed or expelled. Still no one knew that it was Oedipus. Until finally, one of those shepherds who had transferred the baby told him that he was not the natural son indeed, but rather had been found and had been born in another city. This set poor Oedipus to wondering, "Am I the curse myself? Is it me?" And finally, the truth was revealed. Jocasta, realizing what had taken place, hanged herself, and Oedipus, in the throes of the deepest guilt imaginable, gouged out his own two eyes, left the city, lifted the curse of infertility, and wandered the roads until at last Theseus, the great kind king of Athens, took him in, where poor Oedipus finally died. That's an uplifting tale, don't you think? Yes, very sorry about that, but nevertheless, that is the story. And in the Greek mind, it was absolutely impossible to escape your destiny. It had been preset by those three fates. In Norse mythology, they were called the three Norns, but their function was always the same. That was to spin the stories of people's lives. So if you were living in the ancient world, this you indeed believed. That was until the advent of Christendom. And with Christendom came a new way of looking at things. The fates, these three demigoddesses, were tossed out. And no one really took them seriously anymore. From the advent of Christendom and the rise of Jehovah and the entire belief system surrounding Jehovah and the Abrahamic way of looking at the world, there was something called the free will of man. The precept is, God is all-knowing, God is all-good, and God cannot make a mistake. And he is benevolent and has created everything and knows everything in the past, present, and future. And he gives us the choice to either be moral creatures or amoral creatures. Now, a great many atheologians, as they're called, atheists, will say, it is not right at all. We touched upon this one when we had the day talking about the nature of evil. How can an all-loving God allow evil into his creation? He's made us, we're sensitive creatures, we have emotions, memories, loves, families. Why does this happen? And it's been still a controversy, and some people say, no, it still is completely unfair. And that means that God really cannot reasonably exist. But it was the famous the theist philosopher Alvin Plantinga, who back in 1977 erected the most elegant proof to show that no, evil in the world and God are not mutually incompatible, and free will must exist. It has to exist. Otherwise, there's no point in anything existing. And this was his proof. Number one. You can have a world filled with human beings who have no choice in the matter. They must do the right thing all the time. Now, I know that. I know you're all part of that group. But you must do the right thing all the time. And God has designed you to do the right thing all the time. Therefore, there is no grief, there is no evil, there is no sadness in the world. Makes sense. Or there is another world. God has created us, and he has given us not this inability to make the wrong choice, but he has given us genuine free will. He has said there are good choices you can make and there are bad ones. It is useless to me, I who love you so much, to allow you to just make all the right choices, because there's really nothing there. You are automatons in that situation. However, if I grant free will, true moral free will, to either do moral evil or moral good, well, then it is worth more in the long run for me to develop a relationship with those of you who do choose well than it is to have a relationship with automatons who have no choice at all. And so Plantinga very elegantly said, and therefore, evil does exist, but there is very little that that God can do about it, considering that he gives free will to us. If there were no evil, there would be no good, there would be no choice, there would be no praiseworthy behavior. It's fascinating. And to me, it's one of the most elegant of logical proofs out there. However, it leaves, I don't know what you would call it, perhaps a hanging chad. Following the logic, you end up with a situation that if, having done all this and having given us, we wonderful sort of experimental creatures, this amazing opportunity to have a relationship with God, it looks as if you examine it, since God can never do the wrong thing himself, that he has no free will himself. That's a befuddling thought. Am I explaining the logic clearly? Yes? Okay, great. I'd like to read you something. This is a restatement of that final idea. God's free will problem is that because he's incapable of doing anything wrong, he's also incapable of doing anything good, because he's never had a choice either way. Because all he can ever do is right and good. According to Plantinga, if he is all-knowing, loving, capable of running things, and can never be wrong, he can never be good. I would like to offer a sort of middle path, the sort that runs down the midst of the campus. One of the things that we haven't yet added to the mix is the insights of science. A lot of the indeterminism in people's lives came from the fact that we had no scientific grip upon the world. No technological grip upon the world. We were the victims of inexplicable storms, lightnings, explosions. If, as you recall, discussed a little bit earlier in the week, the strange theory of Julian Jaynes of the bicameral mind, and if that were even remotely close to what took place in the human mind 5,000-6,000 years ago, we heard voices constantly telling us what to do, and these were not our voices. Then the ancient world was truly an unpredictable and terrifying place. No one knew what caused lightning or thunder. The Poseidon, the Greek god, was he who was responsible for thunder, called the Thunderer, and earthquakes as well. Zeus threw the lightning bolt. No one knew what was going on. There was no medicine. Life was mean and short and unpredictable. And then we began to have the insights of science. They came along, and suddenly we realized that there was an immense, complex, and wondrous fabric of reality at work. And the great Sir Isaac Newton and a whole lot of other scientists codified the laws of motion, and before you knew it, we had a glorious, predictable sort of clockwork universe. And it became just the most satisfying of paradigms. And it lasted a long, long time. If you set an object in motion, it will tend to stay in motion. And whatever, if you stop it, it stops with the same amount of force with which it was launched, you know, removing friction. Just the glorious laws of motion. And once Newton had this divine, essentially, insight into the nature of nature, then science bloomed, and for many, many years, we had that system, and it was very comforting. But it fell directly into the hands of those determinists for another reason, not the three fates. However, think, if the universe is like a vast clockwork that exploded out at one point and just began to spin itself outward, and our small solar system at the end of the Milky Way among a few billion galaxies all expanding outward, nevertheless is part of the conditions that existed before through time and continue to multiply out through time, then it stands to reason that we are simply as determined as we would be had we had the three fates measuring and snipping our strings. Because, if this makes sense to you, there is really no way to escape the pattern in which we find ourselves. It's as if we leap into a torrent of flowing downstream. Once you're in that torrent, well, you might be able to move to the right and the left, but the flow of things will bear you onward, depending upon how strong it is. But then, in the last, ever since the quantum mechanics discoveries began to be made, that once you got down into the atom, things were no longer able to be mapped. Things were no longer able to be determined. The locus of an electron was a probability. It was no longer a certainty. and then all the other insights of non-locality, spooky action at a distance. If you have a part of a particle out here, you can separate a particle and it'll be all the way out here. And they are almost on an invisible axle spinning particles. And yet, and their communication with one another is instantaneous, faster than the speed of light. And yet, information is being transferred between them. This is one of the great mysteries at large in the sciences today, and is creating a lot of theories. And I know there are physicists in the room. But then, Konrad Lorenz, who was a weatherman and a mathematician, back in 1969, offered up the idea of chaos. Chaos theory said that yes, that within certain parameters of what's going on in the universe, it acts very much like a clock. However, if you have a complex system, such as weather, floating across the United States, any small swirl can, within about a week, be lost completely. And when you have one flow intersecting another that comes up and intersects another and intersects another and continues to complexify, you arrive at the point at which predictive formulas can no longer map what is going to happen. And he, along with the great mathematician Alan Turing, who worked at Bletchley Park during the Second World War and helped break the Enigma code of the Nazis, they discovered that the nature just didn't quite behave the way we thought. And that, once again, has freed us back out into indeterminacy. So I would like to think that there's some sort of middle path. I don't know. This is purely my own personal speculation. I'm not an expert. But if we are rolling along a certain set of possibilities, and yet within the possibilities, there is an unpredictability in our lives that make our lives almost magical. If you think of it, and it seems as if it's almost magical. Joseph Campbell, the great mythologist, referred often to what he called the mysterium tremendum, the tremendous mystery, the unknowable, tremendous, glorious, insolvable thing in which we live and have our beings. And I thought often that must be the only conclusion, certainly the only one that I can draw. Cannot know. Sometimes don't want to know. And yet, the choices that I make impact me and impact others all the time. I can always take solace in the fact that I'm part of the mysterium tremendum. And I'm only a small person. So what do you think? Sir.
I always had the thought that if it was true that omnipotent being, God or whatever, could see the future, it would suggest that there's only one future. And if there's only one future, that future would have to be determined. I don't believe in myself.
Indeed, did you all hear him? Yes, absolutely. I think that marshals a solid argument toward the fact that we are not determined. That is a Calvinist belief. Yes. Parallel universes intersecting ours could well explain all manner of mysteries that we have yet to tease apart. Yes, indeed so. Please.
I'm aware of something in between determinism and free will. I think it comes from the fact that we're animals. I've been really curious about the phenomenon of the food industry and the reading question about that. And there's a book called The End of Overeating, because I was aware of a trip to China about 20 years ago. But I didn't, everybody seemed healthy there. Everybody seemed slender, and no one seemed to have any issues with that. And we all know that growing issues with weight. And in this book, it's explaining how the food industry has discovered that there are ways to make us eat out of control. And there are things in the diet, particularly fat, sugar, and salt, that we have to turn crazy. So I discovered this in myself, and I like to think that I've got to do well. But I've learned that if I know there's ice cream in the refrigerator, it only takes a slight amount of stress, and I'm right there eating it. And the only thing that stops me is like it feels as strong an addiction as I can imagine drug or alcohol being, which thankfully I'm not finding. But the only thing that saves me is not having.
Not having it in the refrigerator in the first place. There is no free will in the face of Ben and Jerry. Know this. Give that up. Yes. Did you all hear her? Oh, would you just stand and encapsulate it one more time?
I became a process theologian. I studied the Holocaust to try to figure out the question of theology, and I came to the conclusion that I was a process theologian, which means that God or whatever it is, organizing principle of the offers us the greatest array of choices possible, and every time one of us makes a choice, it changes the choices for everyone else. And thus, we are co-creators of the reality of everyone, as well as our own reality. And this is a logical way, I think, to derive a moral code.
Way in the back. Yes, it could be. Indeed. Please.
To bounce off the process theologian, I love what you said, but it also occurs to me in terms of environment, the choices we make us co-destroyers.
Yes.
Her comment was that in that great sharing of choices and responsibilities in process theology, we also become co-creators and co-destroyers as well. The question was that last year's speaker talked about Nazi doctors and how they had a split in which they were able to become utterly inhuman toward their subjects. Joseph Mengele, for instance, his specialty was children, and he loved to experiment upon children. It's called the Angel of Death. He escaped for quite some time and was at large after the war for quite some time. By far one of the most notorious of the Nazi doctors. He did not look upon his subjects as human beings. Just the way in the Rwandan genocide, the Hutu radio made sure that all of the Tutsis were labeled cockroaches. That was their dehumanizing approach. Kill the cockroaches. This had a long history between these two peoples, but nevertheless, in the flow of power that entered into the Hutus at that point, they wanted to exterminate the Tutsis. Similarly, the Germans wanted to exterminate the Jews. And so they dehumanized them. And the propaganda that was by Joseph Goebbels and company injected into the iconography of pre-war Germany and Germany at war dehumanized the Jews and made them appear to be animals. And once that split took place, people like Mengele and the guards at the camps and everyone, it was as if we were in an abattoir and cow carcasses were going by. And I think that split comes from the clever use of propaganda and the gullibility of the human mind and the terrifying herd instinct that we have, coupled with a fear of losing everything in the face of implacable enforcement agents. If you have enforcement agents at work within you, and they say, if you do not do this, we will take you, your family, your wife, your children, we'll find your extended family. We will take you and everything that you know out. That instills a kind of terror in people that will, if not force them to be practitioners of this arch evil like Mengele, at least will keep them docile and quiet and not wanting to know. So many people who lived through the war in Germany did not want to know. And they did not seek out the information. I don't know if that's helpful at all, but, sir.
So, I'm just thinking about how, to reiterate how very common stories are, that
Absolutely. Stories are how we organize the world. Are we almost out of time? We are out of time. One last comment, please. For those of you who could not hear it, to conclude, we are the products of evolution, and the only reason we're here is that our ancestors were sufficiently aggressive to ensure their survival and ours. However, there are certain elements, she brought up Fox News, who are attempting to change the way that people think and are attempting to propagandize us, and I could not agree more. Thank you. Have a wonderful rest of your day, ladies and gentlemen.